Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
I'm also a substitute. I'm substituting for Stephen Jackson, who was originally going to be on your programme. Very happy to do that because Stephen has very often helped us out at the Council of Validating Universities, so I'm happy to fill his slot. I'm going to talk a little bit about what CVU is, talk a little bit about my own kind of perspective in the institutional context in which I get my experience of transnational education, but mainly I want to offer some reflections from 20 years' experience in the transnational education field on what I think makes transnational higher education partnerships a very worthwhile endeavour, and some of the things that I've learned and what I'm calling on-the-radar and off-the-radar sort of issues. And I think very much chiming in with some of the things we heard this morning, and I'm going to be talking very much about due diligence, which Nick was talking about earlier. So this is who I am, Director of OU Validation. I've been on the Council of Validating Universities, as Mike said, for quite a long time. And I just wanted to wave that book at you, Quality in Partnership, because a number of the speakers that we've had today, Robin, Nick, a number of other speakers today also have contributed to that. And it's a book that we published a couple of years ago, 2008, when CVU was 25 years old. And it's got articles on transnational partnerships and on all kinds of partnerships. So you might find that interesting. And I'm going to be showing you the CVU website so you can have a look and see whether you can get a copy if you're interested. I'm going to go through quite fast. Because I was substituting, and I find it really hard to say no to people when they ask me to do things. So I said yes, and I forgot that, first of all, I had an OU tutorial on Saturday on Greek tragedy. I'll tell you more about that later if you want to know. Secondly, I also had a sort of wedding, a big wedding anniversary that I was preparing for. And I find it quite hard to keep sort of separate things in my lives apart, so you'll find that there's quite some resonances coming through from both the Greek tragedy, you know, learning through suffering, and from the reflections that I was having around the wedding anniversary and around the relationships and some of the things that you were saying this morning, Vincenzo, around, you know, expectations and values, mutual advantage and shared risk. I was thinking about the people who are going to be coming to my wedding anniversary party and be absolutely astonished that we managed to make it through. And what would I be saying about how we managed to stay together for all these years? And it's all those things, really. It's finding a partner that you can stand next to with pride and not embarrassment. It's about mutual respect. It's about honesty, well-founded trust. And it's about that quality time issue, which Nick was talking about this morning, about actually taking time to get to know one another. And that old adage, marry in haste, repent at leisure, which has also come through as a theme today. So I'm going to go through, because I'm quite busy, a bit sort of driven, I find it quite useful, the opportunity to sort of go up in that helicopter every now and again and have a look and see what's important. So I'm going to take you with me on a little bit of a trip. So CVU, very quickly, I'll go through some of these slides. Membership organisation, an inclusive membership organisation. We, all degree awarding institutions in the UK are eligible for membership. And if an institution, an organisation, has a validated programme, a collaborative programme, they're also eligible for membership. And we have an increasing number of associate members in that category. Those are all the ways in which CVU functions. In particular, I would like to just draw your attention to the handbook for practitioners, which is another resource and which goes through all of the practical guidance around setting up partnerships, the issues around due diligence, around setting up a memorandum of agreement. All those things are all covered in the handbook for practitioners. And CVU works very closely with QAA, So the CBU has a representative member on the group that's looking at the QAA section 2 of the code, and likewise when we review our handbook, we have somebody from the QAA who sits on that group, and it's very much regarded as a complementary publication to section 2 of the QAA code. This is just a little bit about the OU validation activity. I'm not going to sort of read through the slides because I can go over this and answer any questions that you'd like to ask later. So I'll just go through very quickly the activity. We have over 35,000 students currently registered on OU validated awards, and that figure has increased quite substantially. On the previous slide, I put up that there were 29 partner institutions. That's gone down. We did have 49 partner institutions 10 years ago. Now we have 29, but a lot more students. So we're focusing on bigger scale institutions. We very much regard the validation activity as a contribution to the OU's mission around widening participation. One of the partnerships, which if I get time, I'll talk a bit about, is the Arab Open University. Around half of their students are women who would otherwise have limited access to higher education, so we're very proud of our partnership there. Employer engagement, another important thing for the university, and our German partners, Dual Hochschule Baden-Württemberg, has validated programs it offers in association with Bosch, Siemens, Mercedes, IBM, and so on. So we very much regard it as part of the OU mission. Why transnational education? I think we heard quite a lot about that this morning. Very much, as I said, around the OU mission, an ethos about internationalisation, because all of our graduates and as institutions, we need to be competing in a global market, and we want our graduates to be global citizens, so it's important, transnational education from that point of view. It's important around diversifying income, and we know that there's a market demand and a need for transnational education. So these are the countries in the world where the OU either has students or partnerships or both. And so in my day job then, I'm used to using that term validation as having quite a specific meaning, defining that very particular kind of collaborative provision. But for the best part in this presentation, I want to use the word in a much more generic sense. So in my title, Validating for UK Awards in a Transnational Context, validating needs to be interpreted in its broadest sense, just as in the Council of Validating Universities' own name. I'm using that term to capture the way that we as a sector quality assure a very wide range of different kinds of collaborative provision. Practitioners that are managing quality assurance in transnational partnerships, we have access to a whole wealth of detailed evaluation, guidance, and sharing of good practice. Section 2 of the QAA code was one of the first off the press, and it's going to be revised again this autumn. And as I said, the CVU's handbook's been developed to complement that section of the code and offering practical guidance. So while I think there is actually quite a broad consensus around terminology, it matters less, really, what we call the relationship, whether it's validation, franchise, articulation, whatever. That matters less than what those different kinds of collaborative partnerships mean for the respective relationships between the awarding institution, the providing institution, and the student, as Nick was saying. The bottom line, though, is that wherever and however any programme owned by whoever, is delivered to learners that will ultimately lead to those learners gaining an award from a UK university, that UK university is unambiguously responsible, ultimately, for the quality and standards of the award. And the benchmarks and the expectations in terms of good practice, the reference points, as we call them, are very unambiguously those that our sector has spent the last 20-odd years codifying and disseminating. So going back to my earlier points about the basis for a good relationship, it's been my experience that while the international currency of the UK award is highly valued and really attractive to providers and their students outside the UK, that's not always accompanied by an understanding of what makes UK awards so distinctive. In a transnational context, I think there are some common areas which experience and a review of the information that's available through QAA audit reports and so on suggests. Every partnership is different, and this isn't meant to be a definitive list, but they do represent what I've observed to be commonly occurring issues in a number of transnational contexts. Those are the three that I want to focus on, and they include what I referred to earlier as areas that are firmly on the radar for most institutions when they validate transnational provision, and some that I describe as off-radar because they're less commonly considered. So in terms of the pedagogy and learning experience that characterises the intended learning outcomes for UK honours degree, they're really very distinctive when compared to many others across the world. As UK validating universities, this is in our DNA, and it's very definitely on the radar in terms of what we're seeking assurance about when we validate a TNE partnership. But I'm not always sure that we appreciate the wider implications for the partnership, because in the main, this will not be in our partner's DNA. And there is a danger, I think, that we make assumptions about how well understood it really is. You can have a very interesting discussion with your TNE partner about whether the UK approach to undergraduate higher education is better or worse than, say, the US approach, but you can't escape from the fact that it's different and that the award that you're going to deliver is based on is a UK honours award or a master's award. Where another provider wishes to offer an honours degree to their student, whether it's your programme or theirs that will lead to the award, what you as the validating authority have to do is to be sure that they understand what it means and will be able to deliver a learning experience that meets those expectations. UK higher education's approach to teaching and learning and to quality assurance has arguably evolved and been shaped very fundamentally by the distinctiveness of the honours degree. The external examining system and the awarding institutions' moderation and monitoring and benchmarking of standards that rest on top of that, the development of learning resources and pedagogy that supports independent learning, all those things are really closely bound up with the nature of the honours degree. All those features might appear to a partner, and even occasionally to our own colleagues, to be a sideshow to the main event, but it's really important, I think, that you're clear from the start that that's non-negotiable and integral. And it is, after all, what makes the honours degree so attractive and has such currency that our partners want to work with us in the first place. Many of the transnational partners that UK universities work with already have their own degree awarding powers, actually. And what they want for their students is the UK award and all that that means in terms of the distinctiveness and the quality assurance. In my experience, no matter how well established or well regarded they might be as an HE provider in another educational culture, it's quite challenging for them to really understand and internalise what that honours, the ethos of the honours award. And it requires a great deal of initial support and guidance from the validating university. Your partner has to be willing, not resistant, to make that journey with you. Quite a bit's already been said about regulation and legal issues. So I want to link what I want to say about them to the rise of private providers. Whether we're talking about relatively close to home, for example, Greece, or further away in India, Vietnam, or Singapore, the growth of private providers is very striking. And they're not, as we heard this morning, an homogenous group or type. They might be for profit, they might be not for profit. They may or may not be in receipt of public funding of one kind or another. They might be offering exceptionally high quality or poor quality, either in terms of student experience or standards. In some countries, you are probably far better off looking for a partnership with a private sector organisation than with a public sector institution. But in that case, due diligence around the ownership, governance and financial health is going to be essential. They may or may not be operating within applicable regulatory frameworks, and it's dangerous to make too many assumptions or generalisations. Where the increase in private providers and TNE comes together, am I doing all right? Okay. Where it comes together is in regulation, and it's really important as part of your due diligence that you try and understand whatever regulatory issues may be relevant to your collaboration. You mustn't rely on what your prospective partner tells you. You have to find out from some of those sources of information that we've already heard about today. So perhaps I ought to wind up. I'm just going back with those things. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Kate Clark.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.